Good morning, Graham and Mal. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Resplendent, gentlemen. I wonder if we could start with Prigozhin and Ukraine. What do you make of that debacle and the apparent explosion on that private aircraft from Brazil, I gather?
I thought it was Mali.
Well, they were, yeah, indeed. They probably did some of the maintenance, didn't they? In-house job.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's too early to verify anything, I should think. I mean, it may be a John Stonehouse. I mean, he's been dead before in Africa.
They come back to what's extraordinary, is that there is a suggestion, as with the late Saddam Hussein, that there are about 24 Putins available, to open your garden fate or whatever it might be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Usually with an unprecedented level of drama, but they are in circulation. Now, what's your reading of this?
Well, I've been watching some of these historical dramas. There's a very good one on called Livia at the called Domina at the moment about Livia around the time of Augustus Caesar, and also Becoming Elizabeth, one on the relations between Edward, Mary, and Elizabeth Tudor.
If they're well done, they're great, aren't they? Particularly
Yeah, they
ours.
are, and they. But the thing that the way that they just used to order executions and they'd take place and nobody thought terribly much of it. And we're kind of back to that in Russia is no, nobody is at all surprised
White coal, they used to call it, didn't they?
Nobody's surprised when these people disappear. I think it's sort of generally accepted that it's the regime that's bumping them off and that the actual accident rate in Russia must be quite low at the moment, given so many people are being killed off deliberately. And there's nothing you can do about it. That's the Russian regime. You've got to hope that they don't do it too often on our soil, as they have done before, as we'll remember from Salisbury and Litvinenko before that. They are quite happy to do it on other people's territories.
The old oligarch has been found in a state of collapse, haven't they? And their Surrey duplex, and
Yeah, I mean it's just a, it's a medieval regime with medieval values, it seems to me.
But what about the prospects of a Prigozhin, a Wagner rebellion?
I don't know. There was a quite good clip on Twitter this week or whatever it's now called of one of the Putins, we assume. That Putin wears his wrist on his watch on his right
He
wrist.
probably weighs his wrist on his right arm, doesn't he?
Yeah,
Or
and
right.
this particular one looking at his left wrist, where he
Yes.
obviously normally keeps his watch when
More
he's
motor skills than I can
looking at
summon this time of the day.
It does look remarkably like him. I mean, it might even be him, I suppose, who's just forgotten which wrist he wears his watch on. But I it's it, you just don't know what's going on in Russia. The rumours of coups. I mean, Russia's not been averse to the odd coup through history, I guess, but the rumour of coups has come and gone over the years, and
The default
Putin
expectation
looks.
is they're orchestrated by, from some corner or
Well, they're not doing it terribly well, if it is.
other. Bit aleatoric, so to speak. I mean, the wider perspective, it's been an important anniversary for Ukraine this week when they've apparently planted the flag in Crimea tentatively. The advance is slow, but there seems to be cautious optimism over there. And a lot of explosions taking place in Moscow and the surrounds recently, inside jobs or otherwise.
Well, it's horrendous activity going on inside Russia. I mean, there's some very good movie on Al Jazeera on the sort of daily life of young people.
They have very good access to it, don't they? Like
Agents
Rosenberg and
provocateurs.
Thief. Yeah.
They send in agents provocateurs to sort of form groups, and then suggest they blow up the government while they're filming it. And then they get arrested and sent to jail for 10 years,
So presumably, what they're doing is identifying the seeds of sedition, and then, as you say, sort of pretending to stalk them or stoke them. Yeah.
Well, they're not even identifying, they just create the groups, I think,
Yeah.
agents
Yeah.
provocateurs.
I mean, the economically, the weather isn't good out there at the moment. Obviously, there are pots of money stashed in various places. There's China as a client state and all that. But how long could this go on for?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to predict. I mean, it's the end of the Russian Empire now.
Yeah. It's so big, isn't it? I mean, used to say India was an ungovernable. I mean, they managed to get a ambulance spacecraft on the moon this week.
Yeah, and Russian failed.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know,
Well,
some would
it's
say there
the
might be a grand metaphor there, but it's when the eyes are off the ball, isn't it? And whose eyes and whose ball?
Well, it's very linked to the global fossil fuel monopoly. You know, it's been going on building up for 100 years, and now he's losing his market. So, I mean, that's why he went to war. There's a very interesting report coming out by the Rocky Mountain Institute. Reanalyzing the evidence of the International Energy Agency, who've put out predictions of fossil fuel use up until 2050 or 60, and given a linear growth for fossil fuel. And the Rocky Mountain Institute used the same data, reanalyzed, and found that the mathematicians have made an error. And that the curve of renewable implementation is exponential, and it's the only hope that we're going to save the planet.
Well, that's a very interesting piece of reporting. And there's, of course, a whole political argument about the fact that we don't necessarily get to hear these things. There was a footage of Al Gore getting quite impassioned at a recent forum about the little while ago arrest of Greta Thunberg, and the optics of it. But Leonie, good morning. We started off, we're just alluding to the fossil fuel situation there. But we started off, of course, with the Prigozhin and the state of play in Crimea as well. And how are you reading that? And first of all, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You
Sorry,
sound
I just had.
blooming. It's beautiful. Yeah.
How am I reading the Prigozhin situation? Well, I
Yeah.
mean, it's amazing that he stayed alive for 2 whole months after leading a mutiny and marching on Moscow.
Allegedly. Yeah.
Well, I think the leading a mutiny and marching on Moscow is all
Yeah,
not
that's true.
alleged.
Yeah.
I think that
Yeah.
bit's all established. It's astonishing he managed to stay alive for 2 whole months afterwards. I think everyone was slightly confused that action wasn't taken earlier, but clearly he now falls into a category of a long line of people who've fallen out of windows, including hospital windows when they've gone to hospital. Who've been on planes that have mysteriously crashed, and who is the person who is associated with all of these? Oh, poisoning, of course. That's another popular method for Russian leaders to get rid of their opponents. I mean, it seems fairly obvious
Yeah, renowned children's entertainer, available for bar mitzvahs, Masonics.
Yeah, it just seems pretty obvious that it's Putin. He is the person who has most to gain by him suddenly going. And also Sergei Surovikin has suddenly been removed from his position in the army, who was one of the people who was seen as a close ally of Wagner. Well, that seems pretty conclusive to me that one's been bumped off and one suddenly vanished. What can you say? But of course, it may just have been an accident, and perhaps I'm just being unnecessarily suspicious based on previous evidence of people regularly dying who've said nasty things about Vladimir Putin. I mean, who knows? It could just be an absolute coincidence. It's
Could indeed, it could indeed. Of course, there'll be a thoroughly independent, rigorous due process internally. But the economic fortunes of Russia and the progress of the war, sort of this week, has included the Kursk anniversary and Putin scuttling away without making reference to the demise of Prigozhin after a speech, and the Ukrainian flag tentatively planted in Crimea.
Well, you know, it's hard not to feel like supporting the Ukrainians, isn't it? And I think, frankly, we all do. Unless, of course, you live in Russia where you get very little news about the war, or unless you're the leader of Belarus, who is a Russian acolyte. It is, I found it quite disturbing, though, that there's been this summit this week of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Obviously, Putin didn't go in person because South Africa also is part of the treaty that would allow him to be arrested for his various war crimes. So he only joined in via video link.
That's a curious juxtaposition, isn't it?
It's hard to imagine why anyone wants to spend much time associating themselves with Russia. I think,
well, presumably because they think it's their economic best interest in the long term. But yeah.
I guess I can see why. And they have oil, and they have diamonds, and they have gas, and you know they have a lot of natural resources. Clearly, they want access to the natural resources of Ukraine, which I think the entire world is now very clear what those resources are. But it is, I think, wrong for countries to be supporting Russia when they can quite clearly see what Russia has done previously in Syria, where they helped, what the Wagner Group has been doing in Africa. And of course, it's going to be interesting to see what the state does now that they no longer have the plausible deniability of Wagner, because Prigozhin is no longer there to front it up and pretend it's nothing to do with the Russian state. I think they'll just have to admit that there are Russian troops in various parts of Africa, including close to and in Niger. It's what a sorry state of affairs.
It's a bit messy, to say the least, isn't it? Meanwhile, at the Institute for the Study of War mentions that Syria is poking around in Iran and potentially stoking some of those sort of rebellions about the wearing of the burqa and so forth. Around the those concerns of the BRICS as well, to which Iran might be admitted at some point.
Also no surprise, is it really?
Probably not. Graham, any thoughts about that?
Well, all the BRICS, they're all the new expanded BRICS.
Yeah.
Just joining the fossil fuel monopoly. I mean, it's a global monopoly with a war criminal at the head. And so they want to join.
Mm.
So it's definitely dividing the planet into two, for pro-fossil and anti-fossil.
That's a possibility. Very interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's the end of the planet. But hopefully it'll be an economic war against monopolies.
So when the political fig leaves disappear, that's what we would be faced with. Do you concur with that, Mel?
Well, we have to bear in mind that there's still many areas of the world, and South Africa, as far as the S in the BRICS, is quite a good example, where the levels of absolute poverty are still enormous. You know, rural China, we kind of think of China as a developed country. We think of Beijing and the economic powerhouses. But there are hundreds of millions of Chinese who don't have access to reliable water and to electricity and the like. And the developed world, from the time of the Industrial Revolution, has basically, we live as long as we do because of fossil fuel. Our health is as good as it is because of fossil fuel. We have the people of my sort of humble background, as opposed to the aristocratic classes, have time to sit around chatting on radio shows and watching TV and the like because of fossil fuel. Understandably, some of the countries who, particularly in Africa, I think, where there's a lot of oil, countries like Nigeria depend quite a lot upon oil, Just think it's a bit rich.
And the Chinese development of it, yeah.
I just think it's a bit rich that the developed world continues to lecture them on, you know, we're going to enjoy our standards of living, but you can't have it. And understandably, they're saying no. When that's the one benefit, clearly, of the move is that the mineral requirements for renewables are absolutely enormous. I mean, they are environmentally very difficult, I think, many of the renewables, and have caused enormous environmental damage. But it does mean that the mining industries of those countries which have the resources get a boost. The unfortunate thing is that, just the way things have panned out, that a very, very large proportion of the key mineral resources, the cadmium, is one of the most nasty things that there is. There's a video been surfacing over the last couple of weeks of in the cadmium and the cobalt mines in China of young children just, you know, with their hands digging into the resources and bringing them out. Now, those are going to face enormous health difficulties in the future because of the West dash towards renewables. Now, you can argue those aren't Western children, they don't matter. And, but I think that's a pretty callous approach to take. And so we're getting more and more in hoc to China, which has these enormous niobium reserves, praseodymium, neodymium, which are essential for batteries. And
sort of a bizarre recreation of Victorian values in the distant shires. Well,
I mean, the extent to which we put our own selfish needs for the minerals for renewables ahead of the interests of Chinese children. It's almost the whole argument about imperialism being played out again, and it's just really heartbreaking seeing the effect that the renewables industry in the West is having on the health of so many people globally.
Somebody very brave took the risk to film this and make it visible to us, which is pretty difficult to do in China at the best of times. So one of the things that puzzles me about South Africa is with so many developing, in quotes, countries, is that they've had these huge electricity supply problems and the apparent collapse of the infrastructure amidst, the, as you say, the wealth they're sitting on, and the apparent need for some country or other to sort of bail them out with infrastructure to get it back on the road.
Well, it's the inherent problem with unreliable energy sources like wind is that you need to build one grid that operates when the wind isn't blowing. So based on, you know, in China, it tends to be nuclear and coal, where the electricity is reliable. And then a separate grid connecting up all of the wind generators. So when the wind happens to be blowing at the right sort of speed, then the wires are in place to carry that electricity from where it's being generated to where it's needed. Something of the order, the last figure I saw in China was something of the order of 20% of their wind generation capacity just isn't wired up to the grid as yet. And of course, the environmental challenges of new wires in China, not so much an issue because the Chinese government has both the powers and the philosophy to ride rather roughshod over the environment when it comes to these things. But there are many areas like in Tasmania where the new power lines needed to bring the offshore wind into Hobart and the rest of Tasmania is requiring cutting a massive swathe through the Tasmanian rainforest to make way for the new wires. And local environmentalists, rightly many would feel, are up in arms about this.
As for the indigenous people in Brazil a few years ago, under the previous Lula administration, if you put a dam in, you're going to have to recite people and move sites of historic resources for these people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, renewables are very dilute. You don't get, you know, it's just, you don't, there's not much energy in air moving about or water moving about compared to chemical fuel like coal or oil or even more to nuclear fuels like uranium. So you need an awful lot of equipment having a very detrimental effect on the world if you want to pursue that for whatever reason. And of course, biofuels are another order of problem over and above that. They don't even seem to have any significant carbon benefit in the medium, you know, short to medium term, whereas they require, you know, quite a lot of the chopping down of the rainforest when it's not for wind power is for is for biofuels, and these are all classified as renewables, so they all get enormous subsidies from the UK and the EU governments, among others. I think people are seeing through biofuels now. I think there's a real movement at European Union level to declassify biofuels as environmentally friendly. But none of them are environmentally friendly. We've got, you know, the problem is, you know, there's the climate change threat, but there are many other environmental issues for which renewables are the most environmentally damaging of all the energy sources we've yet come across.
Hmm. Graham, I want to come back in a second, but Leonard, can I bring you back in here? This is perhaps a bit of a long shot, but being an august and erudite organisation, does the London Assembly have some ability to make diplomatic overtures to, you know, the Chinas and the South Africans about the situation, and as it were, in terms of commissioning things and trade policy, any kind of advisory role? Do you have some sort of moral audit that is feasible in a situation like that?
We do have some international contacts, and we do occasionally have deputations from other countries who come to talk to us, especially when we produce a report with recommendations and things that are being implemented, and people look at it and think, oh, that's interesting how they've approached that. We might want to go and talk to them. So I've actually had people came to talk to me from Tokyo before the, I mean, obviously the Tokyo Olympics has happened now, because I'd been the chair of the Environment Committee when we did the piece of work on minimising single-use plastic water bottles. And one of the reasons for minimising them is not just that you end up with plastic all over the environment, but plastic, of course, is created from fossil fuels. So it's a pretty wasteful way of behaving. And we then very disgracefully just chuck them around all over the place. And I wanted to talk to me about how can we make a large event like the Olympic Games, if not plastic free, to minimize the use of plastic, because obviously people turn up at sporting venues and buy lots and lots and lots of plastic in non-reusable, non-reusable containers. So I have done some work with events, large stadia in London, and quite a few have now flipped over to using reusable plastic glasses that are, you know, you not rather than those very thin ones that you just use once. So, for example, Lord's Cricket Ground use them. People pay a £1 deposit, and then they take loads of them back at the end of the game, however long it goes on for, or at least the day that they're watching. Obviously, a test match might go on over several days, and they then get the deposit back, and then all those reusable plastic glasses all get reused. So, you know, I was able to talk all that through with these representatives from Tokyo. I also had a
woman in the long room as well. That's quite something. Yeah.
I didn't quite make it into the long room, I'm afraid.
The amount of time, I think.
But I also had a deputation came to talk to me about how we were tackling air quality. This is before ULEZ expansion, so it was a slightly less fraught discussion than that has been of late. And they came from the city of Moscow. I somehow feel that it's unlikely we'll be getting another deputation from the city of Moscow anytime soon.
Well, they might put a dep in, I suppose. Yeah.
we do have these international contacts, and a lot of our reports are published abroad. And in terms of the Council of Europe, we actually have assembly representation in the Council of Europe, which is two of our the assembly members go to those various meetings. However, we don't generally send deputations or have contacts ourselves with countries, particularly over their international policies like trade or anything like that. That would be much more likely to be somebody from the mayor's office, the mayor's team. And they do send trade missions abroad, and particularly London and Partners, which is partly funded by the mayor of London's office and is partly funded by the businesses that probably gain the most from it. So it's a hybrid funding arrangement where they're partially publicly funded and partially privately funded. And London and Partners have got offices in Beijing and various other locations. So they are definitely, of all the parts of the GLA, the Greater London Authority, they're probably out there sort of more on the front line than anyone else, because they're actually based in these countries, and it is very much about trade. But they also have a strong relationship over the issue of bringing students to London as well, because obviously a lot of students do now come from abroad to prestigious universities, and
which is a nice little earner for them, and you know, that's a good piece of work. Yeah,
absolutely. So and also tourism, so those are the areas that they do focus on, trade links, tourism, and obviously that then brings in lots of people who might want to do things like visit London theatres and all that sort of area, but then also the students. And a lot of the Russell Group universities are, of course, various branches of the University of London. So those are probably the main ways in which the Assembly, the Mayor's Office, London and Partners, different parts of the GLA have those relationships on an international level.
So there's a very interesting example of business and regional government working together to the general good. There's been a lot of talk this week about, for example, David Cameron inveterately in his Gypsy Caravan and the Greensill saga, for which Annalisa Dodds is looking for answers. There's still that rumbling on with regard to COVID loans turned down, but the nature of access to Sunak from Cameron by text. You know, as it were, the old boys' network of such it is. And Sunak himself on the stump for a third time, and he's been, as it were, acquitted on the grounds of inadvertency for not declaring a link between a government policy favouring incentivisation of childcarers and a childcare company. I'm not sure exactly what that link is, but it is palpable, and we're told he should have declared it. There are other examples across the summer of politicians on both sides of the House accepting, in some cases, quite sizable freebies. And I suppose the optics of that is a thing. How much of this is necessary? How much of it needs looking at, do we think? Graham and Mal, do you want to pile in on that one?
Well, lobbying is, you know, an essential part of government. I mean, this week I've had, and Leonie will have had the same, you know, residents come up and want to talk to us about things that are going on in their area because they're unhappy about them.
Yeah, but not bearing hampers, though.
No.
Possibly offered a seed cake.
But you do need access. You know, people and, you know, companies, it's quite right that they have access to argue their case. Where it gets very dodgy is, so when the councils, I think our limit at the moment is £25. It might be £50 is the any gift over that we have to declare. But frankly, the vast majority of councils I know would never dream of taking a gift of £25 for something. I want, when I was the environment, I had the environment brief, they got me to symbolically dig the first turf for something that was being built. I can't remember what it was. And I was given the spade engraved with my name on it. And I haven't actually got a garden that's worth calling a garden, certainly nothing you could get a spade into.
Could do with a pitchfork in here, actually, but probably wouldn't be engraved.
So I've got this thing which probably had a value of, I don't know, £40-50, but it was completely useless to me. And so I declared it as I should there, but it wasn't, I hadn't sought it as a gift. And I suspect the vast majority of councillors would be very uncomfortable at taking anything from those. It's not so much solid gifts, if I can put it that way, but there is hospitality. And sometimes, you know, if you're going round to, I don't know, to have a look at the Battersea Power Station developments or whatever, then a sandwich lunch doesn't seem to me to be outrageous, if that's what's that's what's on there. But just to take one example, I have quite regular meetings with the All England Club about a variety of issues, the championship and the golf course. And they invited me round for lunch completely innocently. They know that they you know, I say things as they could be. But it just struck me that it wasn't at all a good idea to have lunch with the All England Club when there's this dispute over the golf course going on at the moment, that anybody seeing that could rightly have said, oh, there's something going on here. And that's, yeah, in local government, I think the standards, broadly speaking, there have been exceptions over the years, but broadly speaking, that culture of accepting, you know, tickets to this, that, and the other, or whatever it is pretty rare in local government. And I think national government could probably learn a few lessons from that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that might strike some people is that if you are in politics, so I suppose you sign up for this, your time is not necessarily your own. You're always on. And the making of these judgments, particularly where things are revealed about a particular operation of which you may or may not have been aware or dimly aware, is a thing, isn't it? Graham, what do you make, generally speaking, of the relationship between business and politics? And are they talking to each other in the right way? Say, comparing it with what the only describes at the Assembly and London and Partners.
Well, I think that's why you have to take the long view of how we got into the position where there's a global energy monopoly for the fossil fuel industry. And they just followed the laws of economics by getting rid of all the competition. And so the renewables and the alternative forms of generating energy weren't developed, and they were suppressed. And so the Standard Oil was broken up by antitrust law, you know, because it's well known in economics that monopolies are really bad for the economy. So it's bad for the world economy, not just national economies. And the way the fossil industry has expanded its monopoly is by working with the secret services in every country and determining the fossil fuel policies. I mean, the worst example is being led by Putin. But the BRICS movement is an illustration of that. Is they want to extend the fossil fuel monopoly against the cleaner, environmental, more beneficial, sustainable forms of technology. And I have a theory that which I've called the bad actor theory, which is that all new technologies are first used by the bad actors because they can ignore the law. So they just go for the profit first. And the population and health and environment suffer because they're ignored. And that's happening with renewables as well as it has done in the past with fossil fuel. It's the people who are applying new technologies in the wrong way that are damaging the environment. And of course, that's happening through economics. It's the economic forces, not the technology that's damaging the environment.
It sounds as if you're arguing for a reform of economics, or at least a adherence to the constitution, if I can put it that way, of economics is a little more rigorous. Mal, did you want to come back there?
I was going to say, I mean, that analysis just doesn't work when you look at hydropower. hydropower is not a fossil fuel. And the biggest dam in the world are in the BRICS countries, in China and on the border between West. I can't remember where it is now. The big Itauha Dam in South America. And hydropower, was quite able to make its way against fossil fuel and become actually hydropower was the first major source of electricity. In the late years of the 19th century, early 20th century, the first house that was powered by electricity in the world was Cragside in Northumberland, which used local hydropower, which had a hydro dam. And hydropower was perfectly able to compete against fossil fuels because of its inherent value. It's something which you can store the power in the dam itself. You can use the power when you want it, as long as there's enough rain that season. So it's a good way of providing, available energy when you want it, which wind and solar do not provide. And the reason wind and solar, which were, there was a massive dash for wind and solar in the early 20th century, Denmark had huge amounts, by the standards of the day, huge amounts of wind generation by 1900. Because we've been generating electricity from wind since the 1880s. But the reason that dash for renewables collapsed in the 1920s was the inherent limitations of the technology, not because the oil industry, which was a relatively small player compared to the hydro industry for many years, not because the oil industry killed it off. The oil industry was never able to kill hydro off. It's because of the inherent problems of dealing with sources of energy that don't come when you want them, in a background where we've still not got any feasible large-scale way of storing electricity. So this whole conspiracy theory just doesn't really work when you stand it up to reality, which, of course, is the nature of conspiracy theory.
Leon, do you want to come back? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. It's not a conspiracy theory. I mean, the term conspiracy theory was introduced by the secret services to exactly close down discussion. And
well, not so here.
Lump all economic planning into a conspiracy theory. You know, to plan is not a conspiracy.
No, I don't think most.
There's a very
depends on how it's specific, done, doesn't it?
There's a very specific definition of lawful means conspiracy or conspiracy, unlawful means conspiracy. Of course, the fossil industry has attempted to use lawful means conspiracy. Wherever it's necessary,
it does bring us back. It's not lobbying, doesn't it? In a way, yes.
Economics is not a conspiracy. You know, the
notwithstanding the cost of living crisis.
The theory of the Adam Smith's theory of the invisible hand. You know, that's not a conspiracy theory.
I'm not saying it's all conspiracy theory. I'm just saying this particular
one. Well, you are. You're saying my theory is a conspiracy.
I'm saying your theory is a conspiracy theory. Yeah. That doesn't
Why?
Mean
Why is it? What's the conspiracy in my theory?
Because everything comes down to a shadowy fossil fuel industry running the world. And I've given you an
example. If it's everything, it's the way the economy works. It's
and I've
not
given you an example.
Conspiracy is between a particular group of people.
Yeah.
Where's the particular group of people I'm talking about?
It's this shadowy fossil fuel industry you keep talking about. And I've given you an example.
You mean the invisible hand? You mean the invisible hand?
Yeah. Well, I suppose people like the Institute for Economic Affairs get cited, rightly or wrongly, as being quietly powerful. You know, the Bilderbergs, the usual suspects. But of course, everyday commerce is a different thing, isn't it? Rather like banks, you know, you go to the bank counter, and then the political weather behind that bank counter is all kinds of sometimes questionable investments.
Malcolm's calling capitalism a conspiracy theory.
Well, I don't know. Let's park
I'm
that.
Calling
there
your interpretation of capitalism a conspiracy theory.
Okay.
Yeah, well, there you go. You see, you always miss the point. And
I'd like to bring up renewable energy. The Belgrano and the Sooty Braden Show Band in their defence. But anyway. Talking about political, and if we could bring in by-election special at this point, courtesy of your student, Georges Monbiot, Mal, and the idea of the South Devon primary that is extending to the good burghers of Godalming and Ash. What do you make of that tendency? And do you want to put that in the context of what's brewing in terms of by-elections this week and upcoming?
Yeah, I mean, there's a real issue in all democratic systems, however you organise them, that the elected representatives have a tension between being the directly locally elected representative, however that's done, even under proportional representation, there's usually some degree of local accountability. The Great London Assembly only is the member for Merton and Wandsworth there and has a particular local responsibility and role from there. And of course, as local councillors or as MPs, we have that responsibility to our direct local electorate. But then, of course, we're also strategic members of the wider body, be it the Great London Assembly or Wandsworth Council or Parliament. And there is a tension there. And there's been a real move in recent years towards emphasising the localness of candidates at the expense of their responsibility to the country or the authority or London or whatever the relevant area is as a whole.
Even and when the electoral literature gets it wrong,
But there's quite a debate going on in the Conservative Party at the moment, which I read through the Conservative news website, about the power of local parties to choose their candidate. And the idea, and it happens in all political parties, of people being parachuted in from outside to stand for what are safe seats. I'm not sure that safe conservative seat, I think, is probably an oxymoron these days. But the and my view always has been it's absolutely the right of the national party to say, right, here's a candidate who, in the case of Labour at the moment, there are, you know, loads and loads of very talented Scottish Labour people who would make a great contribution to Parliament, but there's only one seat at this moment in Scotland, which is Labour. Now, do we take a view of saying, well, the whole of the Scottish Labour Party should be disqualified from Parliament because at this moment, it may change the next election, but Scotland isn't voting Labour? Or someone like Justine Greening from Rotherham, which at that stage was as red wall as you could get, becoming MP for Putney without any direct local link. She lived.
Well, did her research. Yeah.
She moved here and she still lives in East Putney. But of course, it's right that a balance is taken. Now, this move towards primaries that we're seeing seems to me takes that a stage further, that it's now. There's a danger that it becomes even more parochial, even more local, and we further lose sight of the idea that if it's something like a housing development or whatever, and the country is desperate in need of housing, but if a whole string of members of parliament automatically come out against housing in their area because it's unpopular locally, rather than taking a view of saying, yeah, there's an awful lot of people who need somewhere to live, and we should do our bit here locally, then you don't end up getting good national decisions taken. So I'm a bit concerned about the move towards primaries as a way, as they do in the state, as a way where you pre-choose your candidate with a democratic process or quasi-democratic process before actually then going to the election, which is a second stage. So I know it's all it concerns me a bit, I think, the whole move towards overemphasizing the local nature of a candidate at the expense of whether they're actually going to be a good parliamentarian or councillor or Great London Assembly member or whatever, I think probably ultimately doesn't do us any good.
The only Starmer, short of Rees's best known to himself and many of his predecessors, have always ruled out in most cases talking to opposition parties, but at the local level, that's exactly what this is doing. The idea being, as I understand it, to find the candidate who's best placed to unseat, pragmatically, the sitting one, who in the case of South Devon has said this is a threat to democracy as we know it. What do you make of this as an idea? Has it got legs?
I mean, I think it's trying to import something that is sort of how they do things in America, where the primary system includes people voting who aren't necessarily party members but are registered supporters of a party. And we sort of tried something along these lines because there have been some interest.
Ed Miliband, wasn't it, amongst others?
Yeah. Yes, there have been some interest over the years in changing the selection arrangements in Labour. And so under Ed Miliband, when he was the Labour leader between 2010 and 2015, he allowed people to join the Labour Party as some sort of, affiliate
interim
member.
Thing. Yes.
It wasn't an interim thing. There was a new category of membership was established, and you paid £3 instead of however much they charge you at the moment, which I think is about £50 to be a Labour member, unless you're unemployed or a pensioner, in which case it's a lot less. So you paid £3 and you became an affiliated or some kind of registered member of the Labour Party. I can't remember. There was a word that was used for it. And you could then vote in the leadership election that took place after the general election in 2015. So hundreds of thousands of people joined so that they could vote for Jeremy Corbyn, as it turned out. And in London, an awful lot of people joined so that they could vote for Sadiq Khan to be the Labour's mayoral candidate and not Tessa Jowell, who was his sort of main opponent, if you like. I mean, there were a number of other Labour prominenti who put themselves forward, but it came down to a vote between Tessa Jowell and Sadiq Khan. So the creation of Jeremy Corbyn came about because of that. And obviously he then was the Labour leader for 4.5 years and then resigned after a fairly substantial election defeat in 2019. And obviously Sadiq Khan went on to be elected as the Mayor of London and still serves in that position. And I think that has probably, I think the Labour Party has had cold feet because of what happened over the selection and then having Jeremy as the leader, because I think it was felt that, in terms of people having to have some sort of local connection, there are good reasons why having a local connection is helpful. But as much if you are then unable to stop just being a local ward councillor, which is not how you're listed publicly or indeed in any of the council's literature, we are all borough councillors. Or if you are unable to become a London Assembly member for one of the geographical seats, but at the same time understand that your responsibilities go well beyond the geographical area that has elected you, probably is also where you live, you bring your experience and understanding of your local area to the work that you do, but it can't be the only thing that informs the work that you do. And anyone who just thinks, I've become a councillor for, I don't know, Thamesfield Ward, and I'm would be completely wrong. I'm just picking on Thamesfield completely randomly. I'm not suggesting that the three councillors there only see themselves as Thamesfield councillors. I'm pretty sure they don't. Something comes up that affects your specific constituency and you feel incredibly strongly about it. That quite often parties will then allow somebody to vote against their own whip on something that is a sort of local, becomes a sort of matter of conscience, if you like. But usually you are still expected to follow the whip, whatever vote in line with your the other members of your party on an issue, once it has been decided that that's how your party is going to vote on something. So it can sometimes be difficult to balance the local against the perhaps the hyper local against the local in local government, balance your constituency against the regional, or balance your constituency view against the national view. But you have to do that, otherwise you shouldn't really seek to become part of a legislative body, a body that has powers of direction over many local services, or anything like that, if you're unable to understand that you will sometimes need to hold both of those positions.
And it's an interesting challenge for someone like me as an independent who hasn't got a party line to fix. And I know, talking to other independents, that there are a range of views. Some independents stand as part of a local political party, which is different. But kind of, the one person band type independent like me. And I like to think that I do keep an interest in borough wide issues and try and contribute to the wider debate.
Well, rather probably, than
just what's going on in West Hill. But it's a particular challenge. We're mentioning the by-elections. There were only three last night. In Bristol, Greens were defending a seat and they held it very, very comfortably with half of the vote. Bristol now the Green Party is now the biggest group on Bristol Council. And Bristol's particularly interesting because it's had an elected mayor for the last three councils, so the last 12 years it'll be. But in a referendum last year, the people of Bristol voted to go back to a more traditional, if I could put it that way, leader and cabinet style governance. And Martin Rees, I gather, who I've always been rather impressed when I've listened to, I have to say, but I gather he's really pretty unpopular in Bristol now. And indeed, he wasn't selected for the parliamentary seat, which was interesting. So there may be something of a dissatisfaction with his mayoralty. But either way, it does look like Bristol might become the first major city, all due respect to our good friends in Brighton and Hove, but the first, Brighton's a major city, but Bristol...
They had a rocky time of government in Brighton, didn't they?
City yes, with yeah. a, with mm. a Green-run council. And the Greens, when they were running Brighton, did have a no-whip policy, that they would not whip their members. Their members would not be expected to stick to the party line. And it was disastrous. Just two factions emerged who seemed to be at each other's throats. The Greens, despite Caroline Lucas as enormously charismatic MP, the one Green in the country, but despite her presence, the Greens were practically wiped out from Brighton and Hove Council in the elections this year. And there's now a pretty solid Labour administration there in terms of numbers. But Bristol will be interesting to watch. The Isle of Wight, there was an independent. He was actually the Vectis party, but he was the only one in the party. But he was disqualified, in effect, for some very, very serious crimes for which he was received a 2+ year jail sentence. His mother stood in his place in the seat, but the Lib Dems took that. Now, the Lib Dems actually had the parliamentary seat in the Isle of Wight as recently as 2001, but they were down to a single councillor. But having not stood before in this seat, or last time in this seat, the Lib Dems took half of the vote and took the seat when you would have expected it to be a Conservative seat. And then in Dudley, in the West Midlands, one of the poorest local authorities in the country, poor in terms of finance, not in terms of efficiency. But that's run by an extraordinary rainbow coalition of Labour, Independents, the single Lib Dem, who was elected a couple of weeks ago. But Labour took a seat from the Conservatives there on an 11% swing. And that's more like the sort of result that Labour will be looking for in a general election than they've had just recently. My usual caveat, local council elections are not typical of the country as a whole. And indeed, the fact that you've got three different parties elected in the three that went on yesterday demonstrates that. But maybe I suspect Labour strategists will be smiling a little bit more at that result than some of their recent performances.
It's interesting how that rainbow coalition has worked. Later, can I come back to you in a second? Graham, what do you think, more generally, in light of what Malister reported, of the balance between the local and the national? Earlier on, we were talking about the thought process of lobbying as well, and being aware of stuff or being influenced by it.
Yeah, George Mombo is very active in Bristol area, I think.
Really?
Seen some videos of him with public meetings.
Very much around the West Country, and of course the rivers thereof.
Exactly, yeah. Along with Fergal Sharkey, who's now taken up the standard.
Extraordinary performance, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's very much a local issue. I mean, it's a very good example of environment can affect local politics, because people see their own rivers and water supply charges going up and the standard of water going down. And it's now become a national scandal. And it's still yet to reveal itself in London with the tunnel, when the tunnel opens next year. but I think redesigning the voting system, you know, it hasn't really addressed the issue of social media. And that's the biggest problem facing democracy. Is because
shades of precaution again, yes.
Yeah, people can psychoanalyze individuals and target them in secret without them even knowing to swing the votes, and which was what happened in Brexit. So I think that's what politicians should be devising, is voting systems that take account of the advances in modern technology, including AI, which is now No, even the oligarchs wanted a moratorium on AI because they know full well how it can affect their economic position.
So, I mean,
in terms of the European Commission inviting me down to their joint research centre to say exactly this, that they know all the science of the environment and global warming, and they're doing constant research. But the problem is that politicians simply won't listen. And that has absolutely no effect on the policy of European policy. And the same happens here. So
again, it doesn't fit the facts. Though if you look at European,
according to the Joint Research Centre in ISPRA, it does fit the facts. That's why they're invited.
Behavioral psychology is the sort of thing. What you're on about,
Maybe I could expand a little bit on what I mean by that.
Well, you just overtalk someone who is trying to explain it. As a politician, that's what politicians do. They don't.
Well, I interrupt a great. My apologies.
They just want to implement an ideology, which they've worked out for themselves. They want to take power, and that's why Starmer is not going to get elected, I don't think, because people will know that he's just after the power. He's not going to do anything. He's not going to reverse Brexit, so he's not in control. He just wants the power. Well, I think he's going to lose the election or have a hung parliament because of it.
I mean, if I could say, if I am only interested in power, I'm going about it a very, very strange way. I need another another thing.
The power of telling people what to do. That's your.
Sorry to interrupt, guys. I've got to go because it's time. I'm time up, timed out. Speak soon. Have a good one.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. See you.
Thanks, Leon. You too.
Bye. Because
what happened in the early 2000s in the EU was that the environmental movement took over European policy, and you ended up with a string of incoherent policy, like 20-20-20, which was supposed to be 20% renewable, 20% energy efficiency gains. Also, sometimes that was portrayed as 20% energy use reduction, which is a totally, totally different thing, by 2020. And the commercial interests really didn't get a look in, and neither did those who were concerned about security of energy supplies. So the whole of European policy was skewed towards the environment at the cost of everything else. And that ultimately failed because when you get a body taken over, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist myself.
Hoist it on your own petard.
Yeah, I know. I've got to be careful with that. But if you look at European policy in the early 2000s, it was clearly massively influenced by the environmental movement. With all of the strengths and weaknesses that have, it was clearly good that EU was looking seriously at the environment. But when you only look at the environment, then you create an unsustainable situation that when things go wrong, as has happened over the last couple of years in particular with energy prices, globally, but you can also imagine energy security would be a challenge. The other thing you need to keep going with energy. When you get that takeover, then you don't bring the public with you. And that's why to be, you know, so disparaging of politicians because they listen to the public and try and reflect and certainly lead public opinion, but also reflect it, go at the pace that they can bring the public with them, which is the ideal politician who wants to get re-elected has to keep the public with them. To say that that's a matter of ignoring science and so on, that's not what went on. The EU certainly wasn't ignoring science in the 2000s when this policy shift happened. What it was doing was ignoring wider interests that they needed to bring with them. And when politicians do fly off on their flights of fancy, environmental being the most obviously badly managed one recently, it's really not because in some cases there are politicians who genuinely don't believe there's a climate crisis, and they've been elected presumably by other people who don't believe there's a climate crisis, and
they're wrong scientifically.
I think I agree with that. And I think that needs to be approached. But well, just
we heard it in the Republican debate last night across the pond.
I mean, this is what happened with with the Brexit debate, though, is that if you've got, and is happening with Stop Oil at the moment, if you've got an obviously fairly narrow middle class, overwhelmingly white, educated, university educated, articulate, morally self-satisfied group lecturing the rest of the population on what they should do, be it over the environment or Brexit or whatever, then unsurprisingly, quite large numbers of people will say, I'm not going to do this. These people are simply rude to me. They seem to have no... I mean, do you really get the impression that many Just Stop Oil protesters drive a white van for a living or have a passion for snooker, the things that they're quite happy to disrupt in other people's lives? And unsurprisingly, it becomes counterproductive and you end up with a bigger fight than if you'd gone at a more steady pace and said, we want to work on this together.
Of course, the flip side is, for example, Farage and his man of the people shtick, you know, masking the fact that, in fact, he was, at least was, very wealthy in the finance industry. But the ability to actually suggest that there are people who can, relatively speaking, afford to be angry and directly involved in these things has a corollary, doesn't it? And the other kind of politics. Graham, do you want to come back?
Yeah, well, I've got four exhibitions on in Europe at the moment. But I think the art world is gradually coming into, well, it's been in environmentalism for a long time, but it's gradually being listened to as opposed to the fossil industry. And the fossil industry has actively fought against this general consciousness of the environment. So I think I'm not against politicians. I mean, I think the politicians have the most difficult job. I mean, all I have to do is make an artwork and it works for itself. I don't have to constantly go around persuading people of an argument, for example.
Your position is stable, although, I mean, art can be subject to the whims of fashion, can't it, somewhat? And, of course, the commercial market in it. I mean, that's something you're somewhat above, and, you know, very nobly so.
Yeah, I take the point about the commercial distortion of the market private interests.
I don't know, but it seems to me when you say things like politicians are only interested in power and you just do it because you like telling people what to do, whether
no, I'm saying
well,
that's
the word you use.
That is the perception. That is the perception of the population. I'm not saying it as my view. I'm saying when politicians behave like that, then they are perceived. And this is the issue we constantly refer to, is how the public actually see the politicians and why they vote for them.
And this is Monbiot's point, isn't it? The optics, as you say, yes.
Yeah, because they don't have the time to read all the stuff, all the politics and read all the political theory. I mean, they just go by their intuition, gut feeling, about whether the politician is acting in their interests.
I think you're making a very strong case for somebody having a rounded education. I mean, Eton notwithstanding, but others are available, where they are aware of the political economy and what they're getting into.
Yeah, well, people do rely on politicians to explain to them, you know, what the reality is. it's when they tell them lies and distorted versions for their own interests that people get very angry. It's only one of those that if people see that they're only doing it in it for their personal power and prestige, they're not going to vote for them.
Yeah. Can I introduce this as a quick finale, gentlemen? I was hoping Leonie would comment on this, but she's had to rush off. The Lionesses, I didn't see the game. I was watching the Grawniads blow-by-blow analysis on Sunday afternoon. But it's alleged that the Spanish ref weren't entirely on the square. What did you make of it? What do you make of the legacy of it? The fact that perhaps since '66 we were contenders for about the first time.
We weren't regarded as contenders in '66. It was a surprise England victory there. It was brilliant. But whereas this time, I think England probably went into the final as the Lionesses were probably the favourites, having won the Euros just last year. And Spain in women's football not having the quite the predominance that it does in the men's game. So from that point of view, I think there was a little bit more expectation that we were going to come away with the cup this time than was the case. And the disappointment might be a little bit more acute than that. But it was and was noticeable. We went out for Carlson and I went out for lunch on Sunday. And
oh, great.
It was just noticeable that there were no England flags flying out of the windows in the way that there were during the men's World Cup or the men's Euros.
Are they similar to the patriarchy?
Having said that, it was only 1971, was it, that the Football Association lifted its ban on women's soccer?
Yes, indeed. So
to have come that far, during the First World War, there were lots of women's football teams around that sort of period. Mm. And they were all banned soon afterwards. So it's still relatively new.
Yes.
Mm. And the women's game has come an enormous distance. But there's further to go. But there's no doubt that getting to a World Cup final will very significantly help the cause of women's football in the UK. And quite right, too.
Would you agree with that, Graham?
Yeah, it's a very good example of integrated politics where the policy has changed and... then you have an artist making a brilliant film, Bend It Like Beckham, which completely changed the perception of women's football, I think. I think it's
you know, I'd forgotten that. I think you're absolutely right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So it's a triumph for art in that sense, because it wasn't really a political involvement in the
traditional sense, isn't it? Yeah.
Traditional sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a salutary thought on which to conclude for now. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
And you. Bye. And you. Bye.